Today we'll be stepping into the ever-disappearing present with psychonaut, professor, and author Christopher Bausch. His book, LSD and the Mind of the Universe, chronicles his many super high-dose LSD trips over 17 years. To quote him, "I began these sessions as a white, educated male obsessed with the meaning of life, and that's not how I came out." Definitely stay tuned. I'm Robin with Tributaries. Chris, your book, LSD and the Mind of the Universe, is a great chronicle of your years of taking super high dose levels of LSD. We could easily get a 30-minute interview, I think, from almost every page. But since people can get a copy and read it, I'd like to do a deep dive into some of your integrations of these experiences. What do you want to preface this discussion with? Perhaps how many control trips you took, the years they occurred?
Mm-hmm. Well, I did 73 high-dose LSD sessions following a protocol established by Stan Grof, completely internalized, always with a sitter, always in very protected and safe conditions, with eye shades and headphones, completely internal, carefully selected music, and I kept detailed records of each session made within 24 hours. I did this work for 20 years between 1979 and 1999, in the first 20 years, really, of my academic career. I was doing, on average, about 4 to 5 sessions a year with a lot of processing time, a lot of downtown in between. It began kind of as a quest for deepening spiritual transformation, but it became a journey of cosmological exploration as I was drawn deeper and deeper into what I perceived to be the mind of the universe, or we might say the mind of the divine. I did this work for 20 years, and then I stopped in 99. And then I processed and digested these experiences for another 20 years before writing LSD and the Mind of the Universe.
I'm a little curious about using the mind of the universe.
Yeah.
Using that word, well, mind.
Yeah. Very awkward in many ways and uncertain what vocabulary to use. I don't know what to call it. Basically, dissolving into the divine, it's in the consciousness of the universe. Our science tells us, of course, that we are conscious, but the universe is not conscious. The galaxies and planets are not conscious, but psychedelic experience shows us that this is not true.
I would agree
that
there.
That consciousness saturates all reality at all levels, and as complexly organized as matter is, there are complex organizations of consciousness. And so in that respect, when I basically dissolve the boundaries of my mind and systematically drop deeper and deeper into my mind, what I found was that I fell into a consciousness that proved itself in the end to be infinite and to hold all of existence. Now, what do we call that thing? Some call it the Tao, some call it the great expanse of being. Some call it God, some call it deity, some call it the absolute. In my heart of hearts, I call it my beloved, because
beautiful.
It is my beloved. It's all of our beloveds.
It is
the essence of our life and the essence of all life.
Absolutely. You know, and just me questioning that one word, I really want to put out there that there is such a stunning clarity in your writing throughout your entire book. And so I want to acknowledge that and congratulate you for having the wherewithal and obviously having had the experience and really absorbing that experience allowed, certainly, for that clarity.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I worked hard. It took me a long time to digest these experiences and to find a way of bringing them to people and make them available to people so so that it might support them in their own spiritual and personal development.
Wonderful.
So I'm glad that it worked.
Mm-hmm. It definitely did. Now, considering your background, being a professor of philosophy and religious studies, did you start feeling that maybe the saints of old or the gurus or other highly spiritual beings throughout history had also taken plant medicine? Or do you think it was, obviously it could have been just a gracious explosion that happened or deep mm-hmm. meditation through years? Do you see any separation or anything like that?
Well, it seems that as our study of sacred medicines and our deepening of our anthropological research continues, we are finding that sacred medicines or psychedelic substances have played a larger role in the history of humankind than we have recognized previously in the West. And so that some religious figures or some significant personalities in the history of religious thought have been experienced with psychedelic substances. But there are two other considerations, I think, that we would broaden that focus, and that is psychedelics, as I understand them, are amplifiers of consciousness. In the end, it is consciousness that does the work, not psychedelics per se. And therefore, anything that we experience under the influence of psychedelics potentially can be influenced under just straight naked consciousness. And so the cosmology that emerges, at least in my psychedelic experience, is completely coherent with the cosmology that emerges in the great mystical traditions, the great contemplative spiritual traditions, where psychedelics have not necessarily played a significant part. The second consideration is, from a reincarnational perspective, and my first book was on reincarnation, it's just a natural part of my worldview, but from a reincarnational perspective, we are evolving ourselves and evolving our capacities and deepening our experience of consciousness over thousands and thousands and thousands of years, so that people are born, and some people carry many, many lifetimes of conscious attention to their spiritual development. So when they open up under whatever circumstances, on a meditation cushion or with psychedelics or just with life itself, they open up more deeply than some other people who might be younger in their soul's developmental journey. So I think we are tending to over-psychedelicize our reading of humanity's spiritual history, but in the end, I'm sure we'll balance it out and get the right proportions worked out.
I agree with you there. And it's so funny, when you were speaking, I thought, oh, I have a question that will lead into that, but it was later in my interview. And just thinking about how time is and how experience is, none of it is linear. So I feel like this interview will definitely fall into all of that. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
In your book, you talk about the sickness of silence, and I believe that was a reference to not being able to share your experiences in the time, perhaps because you were a professor and also because of where we were in time as far as acceptability and that sort of thing. And yet, there's such a deeper level of all of that, and I think there is a sickness of silence. How do you perceive that now?
Yeah. Well, this is something I introduced at the very end of the book, where I'm describing coming off the mountain. And I'm describing the burden and the challenge that it was to hold all these experiences and only being able to share them indirectly or in very limited form. I mean, I'm a teacher. I love to do research and gather information and share it. And to have such a long history of deep, existentially significant experiences and not to be able to share it, not to be able to teach from it, was very difficult for me. And over the course of time, I was able to do some teaching at the California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco and to teach graduate students and discuss these things openly. But in Ohio, it was harder. I love my job. I love to teach. And the fact that psychedelics were illegal and continued to be illegal largely put the cork in the bottle.
Right.
And made it difficult. And now that I'm retired and now that I can, and I'm past the statute of limitations, I can speak freely about these things. And it has a very healing effect. And it also, it's allowing the two halves of my lives, the hidden side, the psychedelic side, and the public side, the academic professor of religious studies side, to come together and allowing me to become whole within myself in a way that was very difficult before.
I'm sure. And I was curious about that experience of being a teacher in Ohio and not being able to talk about what you were really about. And yet, I'm sure your classes had some very deep insights that perhaps they wouldn't have had if you didn't go on this journey. So was there an ego thing that cropped in there and messed with you in any way?
No, not too much, I think. At least I hope not. My, you know, ego gets pretty much shattered repeatedly in psychedelic work. And
sure.
you learn the futility of getting overly individualistically involved in this, but it was an issue, and of course it was inevitable that I would teach from the spirit of the psychedelic experiences, even if I wasn't talking explicitly about psychedelic experiences. But the impact reached deeper than that. I found that over time, as my psychedelic journey deepened, some of my students began to be impacted by my psychedelic work. There was a sort of a psychological transparency that was opening up in my classroom, even though I never talked about I never let my students know I was doing the psychedelic work. It wasn't part of the overt conversation, but it was as if my psychedelic experiences changed my energy in such a way that I became a lightning growth for the soul development of my students. I was seeing things in their lives or delivering information that they needed to hear, which was beyond my conscious awareness, but was so exquisitely tuned to their life circumstances that it became very powerful. This became such a prominent part of my experience in the classroom that I had to give it a great deal of thought and eventually wrote a small book on it. It's called The Living Classroom. And it's about the dynamics of fields of consciousness in groups. And in this book, I don't even mention psychedelics, because psychedelics are not the primary point. The primary point is the nature of consciousness itself. And when one person goes very deep into consciousness and clarifies their own consciousness and begins to experience deeper and deeper dimensions of consciousness, it's just inevitable. It's like throwing a stone into a lake, that the ripples of this flow out and touch the lives of people around us. And that's what The Living Classroom is about.
Yeah, that's a great name for a book about that. You can really see when people approach you, right, what the attraction mm-hmm. is. On a deeper level, you get what they're coming after. They may just be mm-hmm. asking you for a cup of water. I mean, that's a ridiculous example, but mm-hmm. but the request mm-hmm. or the initial connection, one would recognize that superficiality of that,
mm-hmm.
whereas the deeper connection to that God or the grace or whatever you want to call it is the reason for the connection. And it's also interesting how people can get kind of tripped up by that, and they get connected to the person instead of that deeper mm-hmm. thing that's going on.
Mm-hmm. It was fortunate that I had the opportunity to study continuously great spiritual contemplatives, the great masters, and they really help ground you on what's important and what's not important, what's happening, and the importance of staying always compassionate, always clear, and always doing your best to support other people. Part of the challenging part for me was I wasn't consciously aware how these things were happening or even what was happening. These things operated beneath the level of personal consciousness. They were like soul-to-soul connections.
Right.
So you're kind of learning how to ride a river that you're not in control of. And it requires, I found, tremendous impeccability. It gets very complicated if you get personally, insert your person into it. It requires a tremendous impeccability. And I think good teachers all recognize that impeccability and all cultivate that kind of impeccability.
Yes, absolutely. And to quote part of a sentence from your book, you write, "Temporarily freed from the lazy habit of thinking in terms of selves." I thought that was so interesting that you used the words lazy and a habit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, we do have these patterns that we just kind of adopt and we stick with instead of staying to the freshness of what's happening in front of us and within us at this deeper level.
Did you mean it to mean something in relationship to selves as opposed to how the we would change for you over time?
Well, you know, classically, our Western thinking has tended to emphasize the separation of our minds from each other. I mean, teachers deal with this all the time. Students don't know what we know. We have to work very hard to help them understand what we understand. It's clear that our minds are differentiated and separate. And yet, when one does deep spiritual work, and I include psychedelic work in this form, one experiences a second truth, and that is the truth of interconnectivity, interpenetration, underlying patterns of wholeness, patterns of inclusion. And so many people experience these openings in different ways and in different contexts. Spiritual teachers may experience them opening in their contemplative practice or on their meditation cushion. One of the ways that I experienced it was in the classroom. So in the classroom, we were clearly meeting as individual minds, and that's the truth. But then there's this deeper truth where, first, we're meeting as souls, so there's a temporal depth to our connection, to our relationships. But then underneath, there's a still deeper level where we're meeting within the flows of consciousness, within fields of consciousness, which exist within historical periods and exist within certain landscapes. And when one sees these things, when you understand them, then it's like standing in the air, breathing air, having air in your body, but knowing that this is part of a larger current of air, or standing in water and feeling the current around you and yet occupying one point in the water. It's an interesting kind of both and condition to be both individual and yet also tuning to that which is trans-individual. And this is something that I learned to balance in the classroom as best I could.
Yes, and you certainly went through just reams of horrific experiences or frightening experiences in these journeys. And perhaps some would never have continued because they were so horrific. And then you mentioned the river. Did you reach a point where no matter what you moved through or what came at you, you could just have that air in you and let it all pass through? Or was there still struggle with something like that when you finished this set of journeys?
No struggle, no any lingering after effects of the suffering that's part of the journey. In fact, it was one of my major concerns when I was writing the book that people would be with the depth of suffering that it contained. And suffering is simply part of the process, not because life wants us to suffer, but because we are small. We start out small. And if we want to have communion or dissolve into that which is larger, if we want to dissolve into the mind of the universe or into the mind of the divine, then we have to let go of our smallness. We have to literally die as something small in order to inherit that which is large, that about our being which is large. And this death-rebirth process is difficult. process for most of us.
Yes.
Even with practice, it gets easier. But the early death, which we, you know, ego death or the death of self described in our spiritual traditions, in my case, were followed by other deaths at levels of the species mind and deaths at the level of archetypal mind, deaths at the level of the one mind, the causal mind. And it's simply a matter of surrendering. Well, let me back up. In this work, there is a cycle of deepening immersion into the layers and layers and layers of existence. And each time you are at that gateway where you are potentially moving from one level to another, there is a threshold one comes to. And there is a surrender that is required where you have to let go of everything you have known and been, even within your earlier psychedelic sessions, if you are going to make this transition to become operational at this deeper level of existence and where you can have different kinds of experiences and different kinds of understandings. And then if you continue to press the edges, you will eventually come to another threshold, another gateway, and you will have to go through another death rebirth process in order to transition into yet another level. The reason there was so much suffering is simply because the nature of the practice that I had adopted was so powerful. It had the power, and I cooperated with this power, to let it take me through many such gateways, many such thresholds. But the other reason there is so much suffering is because I pressed this method as hard as I did, and maybe I pressed it harder than was wise, and I truly do not recommend other people to press this method as hard as I did. If I were doing it over again, I would be gentler. I would take a slower route into the infinite. Part of the reason there was so much suffering simply was because out of my own partly naivete and out of my own eagerness to know more, to understand more, to reach out and be taken deeper in. And there's a price to be paid to become one with deeper and deeper orders of existence. That's all. It's a purification process. It's just a purification process.
Yes. Now, you mentioned the causal mind.
Mm-hmm.
Would you talk about that just for a moment?
It's a category which spiritual writers will use. The progression, as I experience it, when I let go of my time-space identity, and I'll generalize because I think this is a widely shared experience, one enters into spiritual reality or transpersonal reality, and one experiences some dimension of the spiritual universe. But it tends to be colored by the reality that one is leaving of time-space reality. And as one purifies one's experience and goes deeper and deeper, one enters into larger and larger structures. So instead of experiencing just your personal unconscious, you enter into the collective unconscious, into the species mind. And then you can go deeper into some of the archetypal dynamics of the deep structure of consciousness. But eventually one comes to a point where all those dualities, all those divisions become dissolved, and one is taken into a state of awareness in which the entire universe moves and pulses as a single living being. This has been known for ages. I mean, Plotinus says everything breathes as one. And that's the experience at the causal level, that there is diversity, there are differences, there are colors and textures and movement, but the entire totality is a single consciousness which is pulsing and breathing and living through this tremendous diversity of life. That's what I mean by the causal mind, the causal oneness.
Does that have anything to do with cause and effect and moving beyond that?
No, it doesn't. In the sense, the causal mind in this context doesn't refer to cause and effect, except that this one mind is the deep, metaphysical cause of time-space reality. But primarily, I mean, people will differentiate between psychic level, subtle level, causal level, and non-dual levels of consciousness. And causal fits into that sequence. Causality, time-space causality, physical causality, psychological causality is all part of the warp and woof of the matrix of the universe, of existence. But when one, in a sense, enters causal reality or enters the level of oneness, there is a sense in which, while not canceling out the patterns of cause and effect, one transcends those patterns and lives a life in which those patterns pulse in one and around one, but it doesn't affect the fundamental oneness that you are at that moment part of, drawn into.
Yes, beautifully said, beautifully said. We'll continue this journey next week with Chris Bache, author of LSD and the Mind of the Universe, next week. For anything Tributaries related, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com, and podcasts are on the usual platforms. And if not, please do get in touch. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.